Not all of Philip Lascelles, not even most of him, had come back. Unlike those who had gone before him, his body had not been pulped and shredded by incomprehensible forces near the boundary. But something no less final appeared to have happened to his mind. Nothing remained of his personality, except for a few residual traces which served only to heighten the almost absolute obliteration of everything else. Enough brain function remained for him to keep himself alive without machine assistance, and his motor control seemed completely unimpaired. But there was no intelligence left. No sense that Lascelles perceived his surroundings except in the most simplistic manner, no indication that he had any grasp of what had happened to him, or was even aware of the passage of time. No indication that he retained the ability to memorize new experiences, or retrieve those that had happened to him before his trip to the Shroud. He retained the ability to vocalize, but while Lascelles occasionally spoke well-formed words, or even fragments of sentences, nothing he uttered made the slightest sense. Lascelles, or what remained of Lascelles, was returned to the Yellowstone system, and then to the SISS habitat, where medical experts desperately tried to construct a theory for what might have happened. Eventually, and it was more out of desperation than logic, they decided that the fractal, restructured space-time around the Shroud had not been able to support the information density of his brain. In passing through it, his mind had been randomized on the quantum level, although the molecular processes of his body had not been noticeably affected. He was like a text which had been transcribed imprecisely, so that much of the meaning was lost, and then re-transcribed. Yet Lascelles was not the last person to attempt such a suicide mission. A cult had grown up around him, its chief rumor being that, despite his exterior signs of dementia, the passage close to the Shroud had bestowed on him something like nirvana. Once or twice every decade, around the known Shrouds, someone would attempt to follow Lascelles into the boundary, and the results were miserably uniform, and no improvement on what Lascelles himself had achieved. The lucky ones came back with half their minds gone, while the unlucky ones never made it back at all, or did so in ships so mangled that their human remains resembled a salmon-colored paste. While Lascelles' cult bloomed, people soon forgot about the man himself. Perhaps the salivating, mumbling reality of his existence was a touch too uncomfortable. Sylvester, however, did not forget. More than that, he had become obsessed with teasing a last vital truth out of the man. His familial connections guaranteed him an audience with Lascelles whenever he wanted, provided he ignored Calvin's forebodings. And so he had taken to visiting, and waiting in absolute patience while Lascelles attended to his pavement drawings, ever watchful for the one transient clue which he knew the man would eventually bequeath him. In the end, it was a lot more than a clue. It was difficult to remember how long he had waited, on that day when the waiting finally paid off. For all that he intended to focus his mind with absolute attentiveness on what Lascelles was doing, he had been finding it increasingly difficult. It was like staring intently at a long series of abstract paintings. One's concentration inevitably began to wane, no matter how much one tried to keep it fresh. Lascelles had been halfway through the sixth or seventh hopeless chalk mandala of the day, executing the task with the same fervent dedication he brought to every mark he made. Then, with no forewarning, he had turned to Sylvester and said with complete clarity, "The jugglers offer the key, Doctor." Sylvester was too shocked to interrupt. "It was explained to me," Lascelles continued blithely, "while I was in revelation space." Sylvester forced himself to nod as naturally as possible. Some still calm part of his mind recognized the phrase which Lascelles had spoken. As far as anyone had ever been able to tell, it was what Lascelles now called the Shroud boundary, space, in which he had been granted certain revelations too abstruse to relate. Yet now his tongue seemed to have been loosened. "There was a time when the Shrouders travelled between the stars," Lascelles said, "much as we do now. Although they were an ancient species and had been starfaring for many millions of years, they were quite alien, you know." He paused to switch a blue chalk for a crimson one, placing it between his toes. With that he continued his work on the mandala. But with his hand, now free from that task, he began to sketch something on an adjacent patch of ground. The creature he drew was multi-limbed, tentacled, armor-plated, spined, barely symmetrical. It looked less like a member of a star-faring alien culture than something which might have flopped and oozed its way across the bed of a Precambrian ocean. It was utterly monstrous.
"That's a Shrouder?"
Sylvest said, with a shiver of anticipation.
"You actually met one?"
"No. I never truly entered the Shroud," Lascaille said. "But they communicated with me. They revealed themselves to my mind, imparted much of their history and nature." Sylvest tore his gaze away from the nightmarish creature.
"Where do the jugglers come into it? The pattern jugglers have been around for a long time, and they're to be found on many worlds. All starfaring cultures in this part of the galaxy encounter them sooner or later."
Lascaille tapped his sketch.
"Just like we did. So did the Shrouders, only very much earlier. Do you understand what I'm saying, Doctor?"
"Yes, sir."
He thought he did anyway. "But not the point of it." Lascaille smiled.
"Whoever, or whatever, visits the jugglers is remembered by them.
Remembered absolutely, that is, down to the last cell, the last synaptic connection. That's what the jugglers are, a vast biological archiving system." This was true enough, Sylvester knew. Humans had gleaned very little of significance concerning the jugglers, their function or origin. But what had become clear almost from the outset was that the jugglers were capable of storing human personalities within their oceanic matrix, so that anyone who swam in the juggler sea and was dissolved and reconstituted in the process would have achieved a kind of immortality. Later, those patterns could be realized again, temporarily imprinted in the mind of another human. The process was muddy and biological, so the stored patterns were contaminated by millions of other impressions, each subtly influencing the other. Even in the early days of juggler exploration, it had been obvious that the ocean had stored patterns of alien thought, hints of otherness bleeding into the thoughts of the swimmers, but these impressions had always remained indistinct.
"So the Shrouders were remembered by the jugglers," Sylvester said.
"But how does that help us?"
"More than you realize.
The Shrouders may look alien, but the basic architectures of their minds were not completely dissimilar to our own. Ignore the body plan. Realize instead that they were social creatures with a verbal language and the same perceptual environment. To some degree, a human could be made to think like a Shrouder, without becoming completely inhuman in the process." He looked at Sylvester again.
"It would be within the capabilities of the jugglers to install a Shrouder neural transform within a human neocortex."
It was a chilling thought. Achieve contact not by meeting an alien, but by becoming it, if that was what Lascaille meant.
"How would that help us?"
"It would stop the Shroud from killing you."
"I don't follow you."
"Understand that the Shroud is a protective structure, what lies within our, not just the Shrouders themselves, but technologies which are simply too powerful to be allowed to fall into the wrong hands. Over millions of years, the Shrouders combed the galaxy seeking harmful things left over by extinct cultures, things which I can almost not even begin to describe to you. Things which may once have served good, but which are also capable of being used as weapons of unimaginable horror. Technologies and techniques which may only be deployed by ascended races, means of manipulating space-time, or of moving faster than light. Other things which your mind literally can't encompass."
Sylvester wondered if that really were the case.
"Then the Shrouds are, what,
treasure chests? Where only the most advanced races get the keys?"
"More than that. They defend themselves against intruders. A Shroud's boundary is almost a living thing. It responds to the thought patterns of those who enter it. If the patterns do not resemble those of the Shrouders, it fights back. It alters space-time locally, creating vicious eddies of curvature. Curvature equals gravitational shear stress, Doctor. It rips you apart. But the right kinds of mind, the Shroud admits them, guides them closer, protects them in a pocket of quiet space. The implications, Sylvester saw, were shattering. Think like a shrouder and one could slip past those defenses, into the glittering heart of the treasure box. So what if humans were not advanced enough by shrouder reckoning to behold that treasure? If they were clever enough to break open the box, were they not entitled to take what they found? According to Lascaille, the shrouders had assumed the role of galactic matron when they secreted those harmful technologies. But had anyone asked them to do it? Then another question ghosted into his mind. Why did they let you know this, if what was inside the shrouds had to be protected at all costs?
I don't know if it was intentional. The barrier around the shroud that bears my name must have failed to identify me as alien, if only fleetingly. Perhaps it was damaged, or perhaps my state of mind confused it. Once I had begun to penetrate the shroud, information began to flow between us. That was how I learned these things. What the shroud contained, and how its defenses might be circumvented. It's not a trick machines can learn, you know.
The last remark seemed to have come from nowhere. For a moment it hung there before Lascaille continued.
But the shroud must have begun to suspect that I was foreign. It rejected me, flung me back out into space.
Why didn't it just kill you?
It must not have been completely confident in its judgment.
He paused. In revelation space, I did sense doubt. Vast arguments taking place around me, quicker than thought. In the end, caution must have won the day. Now another question, the one he had wanted to ask since the moment Lascaille had opened his mouth.
Why have you waited until now to tell us these things?
I apologize for my earlier reticence. But first I had to digest the knowledge that the Shrouders had placed in my mind. It was in their terms, you see, not ours.
He hesitated, his attention seemingly drawn to a smudge of chalk which was marring the mathematical purity of his mandala. He licked his finger and rubbed it away.
That was the easy part.
Then I had to remember how humans communicate.
Lascaille looked at Sylvester, his animal eyes veiled by a Neanderthal tangle of uncombed hair.
You've been kind to me.
Not like the others.
You had patience with me.
I thought this might help you.
Sylvester sensed that this window of lucidity might soon be closing.
How exactly do we persuade the jugglers to imprint the shroud of consciousness pattern? That's the easy part.
He nodded at the chalk drawing.
Memorize this figure, and hold it in mind when you swim.
That's all?
It will suffice. The internal representation of this figure in your mind will instruct the jugglers as to your needs. You'd better take them a gift, of course. They don't do something of this magnitude for free.
A gift?
Sylvester was wondering what kind of gift one could possibly offer to an entity which resembled a floating island of seaweed and algae.
You'll think of something. Whatever it is, make sure it's information dense. Otherwise you'll bore them. You wouldn't want to bore them.
Sylvester wanted to ask further questions, but Lascaille's attention had returned to his chalk drawings.
That's all I have to say, the man said.
It turned out to be the case. Lascaille never spoke to Sylvester or anyone else again. A month later they found him dead, drowned in the fish pond.
Hello? Cody said. Is there anyone here?
She had awoken, that was all she knew. Not from a catnap, either, but from something much deeper, longer and colder. A reefer sleep fugue, almost certainly. They were not something you forgot, and she had woken from one before, around Yellowstone. The physiological and neural signs were exactly right. There was no sign of a reefer sleep casket. She was lying fully clothed on a couch, but someone could easily have moved her before she was properly conscious.
Who, though? And where was she?
It seemed as if someone had tossed a grenade into her memory, blowing it into frags. The place where she found herself now was only teasingly familiar.
Someone's hallway?
Wherever it was filled with ugly sculptures. She had either walked past these things a matter of hours ago, or else there were recessive figments from the depths of her childhood, nursery horrors. Their curved, jagged, and burnt shapes loomed over her, casting demon-like shadows. Groggily she intuited that these things fitted together in some way, or had once done so, though they were perhaps too warped and torn for that now. Footsteps padded unsteadily across the hallway. She twisted her head to view the approaching person. Her neck felt stiffer than curved wood. Years of experience had told her that the rest of her body would be no more supple after the sleep fugue. The man stopped a few paces from her bed. In the moonlight glow of the chamber it was hard to read his features, but there was a familiarity within the shadowed jowliness that tugged at her memory. Someone she had known many years ago. "It's me," he said, the voice wet and phlegmatic. "Manoukian. The mademoiselle thought you might appreciate a familiar face when you woke up." The names meant something to her, but exactly what it was hard to say. "What happened?"
"Simple. She made you an offer you couldn't refuse."
"How long have I been asleep?"
22 years,
Manoukian said, offering her a hand.
"Now, shall we go and see the mademoiselle?"
Sylvestre woke, facing a wall of black which swallowed half the sky, a black so total that it seemed like a nullification of existence itself. He had never noticed it before, but now he saw, or imagined he saw, that the ordinary darkness between the stars was in fact aglow with its own milky luminosity. But there were no stars in the circular pool of emptiness which was the sky's shroud. No source of any light whatsoever, no photons arriving from any part of the detectable electromagnetic spectrum, no neutrinos of any flavor, no particles, exotic or otherwise. No gravity waves, electrostatic or magnetic fields, not even the slight whisper of Hawking radiation, which, according to the few extant theories of shroud mechanics, ought to be bleeding out of the boundary, reflecting the entropic temperature of the surface. None of these things happened. The only thing a shroud did, so far as anyone had ever been able to tell, was to comprehensively obstruct all forms of radiation attempting to pass through it. That, of course, and the other thing, which was to shred any object daring to pass too close to its boundary. They had woken him from reefer sleep, and now he was in the state of sickening disorientation which accompanied the crash revival, yet young enough to weather the effects. His physiological age was only 33, despite the fact that more than 60 years had passed since his birth.
"Am I all right?"
he struggled to ask the revival medicos, while all the time his attention was being snared by the nothingness beyond the station window, like someone staring into the black counterpart of a snowstorm.
"You're almost clear," said the medico next to him, watching neural readouts scroll through midair,
digesting their import with quiet taps of a stylus against his lower lip.
"But Valdez faded. That means Lefebvre's bumped up to primary. Think you can work with her?"
"Bit late for doubts now, isn't it?"
"It's a joke, Dan. Now, how much do you remember? Revival amnesia's the one thing I haven't scanned for."
It seemed like a stupid question, but as soon as he interrogated his memory, he found it responding sluggishly, like a document retrieval system in an inefficient bureaucracy.
"Do you remember Spindrift?" the medico asked, with a note of concern in his voice.
"It's vital that you remember Spindrift."
He remembered it, yes, but for a moment he could not connect it with any other memories. What he remembered, the last thing he remembered which was not adrift, was Yellowstone. They left it 12 years after the 80, 12 years after Calvin's corporeal death, 12 years after Philip Lascaille had spoken to Sylvestre, 12 years after the man had drowned himself, his purpose seemingly fulfilled. The expedition was small but well-equipped, a light-hugger crew, partially chimeric, ultranauts who seldom mingled with the other humans, 20 scientists largely culled from SISS, and 4 potential contact delegates. Only 2 of the 4 would actually travel to the surface of the shroud.
Lascaille's shroud was their objective, but not their first port of call. Sylvestre had heeded what Lascaille had told him. The pattern jugglers were vital to the success of his mission. It was first necessary to visit them on their own world, 10s of light-years from the shroud. Even then Sylvestre had little idea of what to expect. But rash as it seemed,
He trusted Lascaille's advice. The man would not have broken his silence for nothing.
The jugglers had been a curiosity for more than a century. They existed on a number of worlds, all of them dominated by single planet-sized oceans. The jugglers were a biochemical consciousness distributed through each ocean, composed of trillions of co-acting microorganisms arranged into island-sized clumps. All the jugglers' worlds were tectonically active, and it was theorized that the jugglers drew their energy from hydrothermal outlet vents on the seabed, that the heat was converted to bioelectrical energy and transferred to the surface via tendrils of organic superconductor draping down through kilometers of black cold. The jugglers' purpose, assuming they had a purpose, remained completely unknown. It was clear that they had the ability to mediate the biospheres of the worlds in which they had been seeded, acting like a single, intelligently acting mass of phytoplankton, but no one knew if this was merely secondary to some hidden, higher function. What was known, and again not properly understood, was that the jugglers had the capacity to store and retrieve information, acting like a single, planet-wide neural net. This information was stored on many levels, from the gross connectivity patterns of surface-floating tendrils down to free-floating strands of RNA. It was impossible to say where the oceans began and the jugglers ended, just as it was impossible to say whether each world contained many jugglers or merely one arbitrarily extended individual, for the islands themselves were linked by organic bridges. They were world-sized living repositories of information, vast informational sponges. Almost anything entering a juggler ocean would be penetrated by microscopic tendrils, partially dissolved until its structural and chemical properties had been revealed, and that information would then be passed into the biochemical storage of the ocean itself. As Lascaille had intimated, the jugglers could imprint these patterns as well as encode them. Supposedly those patterns could include the mentalities of other species which had come into contact with the jugglers, such as the Shrouders. Human study teams had been investigating the pattern jugglers for many decades. Humans swimming in the juggler-infested ocean were able to enter rapport states with the organism, as juggler micro-tendrils filtered temporarily into the human neocortex, establishing quasi-synaptic links between the swimmers' minds and the rest of the ocean. It was, they said, like communing with sentient algae. Trained swimmers reported feeling their consciousness expand to include the entire ocean, their memories becoming vast, verdant, and ancient. Their perceptual boundaries became malleable, although at no point was there any sense that the ocean itself was truly self-aware, more that it was a mirror, massively reflecting human consciousness, the ultimate solipsism. Swimmers made startling breakthroughs in mathematics, as if the ocean had enhanced their creative faculties. Some even reported that these boosts persisted for some time after they had left the oceanic matrix and returned to dry land or orbit. Was it possible that some physical change had taken place in their minds? So it was that the concept of the juggler transform arose. With additional training, the swimmers learned how to select specific forms of transform. Neurologists stationed on the juggler world attempted to map the brain alterations wrought by the aliens, but with only partial success. The transformations were extraordinarily subtle, more akin to returning a violin than ripping it apart and building it from scratch. They were rarely permanent. Days, weeks, or very occasionally years later, the transform would fade. Such was the state of knowledge when Sylvestre's expedition reached the juggler world Spindrift. Now he remembered it, of course. The oceans, the tides, the volcanic chains, and the constant overpowering seaweedy stench of the organism itself. Smell unlocked the rest. All four potential Shrouder contact delegates had learnt the chalk diagram on a deep level of recall. After months of training with expert swimmers, the four entered the ocean and filled their minds with the form Lascaille had given them. The juggler had reached into them, partially dissolved their minds, and then restructured them according to its own embedded templates. When the four emerged, it seemed at first that Lascaille had been crazy after all.
They did not exhibit freakishly alien modes of behavior, nor had they suddenly gained answers to great cosmic mysteries. Questioned, none of them reported feeling particularly different, nor were they any the wiser about the identity or nature of the Shrouders. But sensitive neurological tests probed deeper than human intuition. The spatial and cognitive skills of the four had changed, though in ways that were perplexingly difficult to quantify. As days passed, they reported experiencing states of mind that were, paradoxically, both familiar and yet utterly alien. Evidently, something had changed, though no one could be sure that the states of mind they were experiencing had any connection with the Shrouders. Nonetheless, they had to move quickly. As soon as the initial tests were complete, the four delegates entered reefer sleep. The cold prevented the juggler transforms from decaying, though they would inevitably begin to fade once the four were awakened, despite a complicated regimen of experimental neuro-stabilizing drugs. They were kept asleep throughout the voyage to Laskyle Shroud, then for weeks in the vicinity of the object itself, as their study station was maneuvered closer, within the nominal 3 AU safe distance which it had maintained until that point. Even then, the delegates were not awoken until the eve of their trip to the surface.
"I remember," Sylvest said. "I remember Spindrift."
And then there was a moment while the medico kept tapping his stylus against his lips, assimilating the reams of information pouring from the medical analysis systems, before nodding and passing him fit for the mission. "The old place has changed a bit," Manukian said. He was right, Kuri saw. She was looking out over something she hardly recognized as Chasm City. The mosquito net was gone. Now the city was open to the elements once more, its buildings rising nakedly into Yellowstone's atmosphere, where once they had sheltered beneath the merged drapery of the domes. The Mademoiselle's black chateau was no longer amongst the tallest structures. Tiered, aero-formed monsters knifed into the broiling brown sky, like shark's fins, or blades of spinifex, slashed by countless scores of tiny windows, emblazoned with the giant Boolean logic symbols of the conjoiners. Like yacht sails, the buildings rose from what remained of the mulch on slim masts, so that their leading edges cut into the wind. Only a scattering of the old, gnarled architecture remained, and only a vestigial remnant of the canopy. The old city forest had been slashed into history by the shining, blade-like towers.
"They grew something in the chasm," Manukian said, "right down in the depths. They call it the lily."
His voice took on a tone of fascinated repulsion. "People who've seen it say it's like a huge piece of breathing viscera, like a piece of God's stomach. It's fastened to the walls of the chasm. The stuff belching out of the depths is poisonous, but by the time it's been through the lily, it's just about breathable. All this in 22 years.
"Yes," someone answered. Movement played in the gloss-black armor of the shutters.
Kuri turned around in time to catch a palanquin, resting silently. Seeing it, she remembered the Mademoiselle and much else, too. It was as if no more than a minute had elapsed since their last meeting.
"Thank you for bringing her here, Carlos."
"Will that be all?"
"I think so."
Her voice echoed slightly.
"Time is of the essence, you see, even after all these years. I've located a crew who need someone like Kuri, but they won't wait for more than a few days before leaving the system. She will need to be educated, primed in her role, and introduced to them before we lose this opportunity."
"What if I say no?" Kuri said.
"But you won't, will you?
Not now that you know what I can do for you.
You do remember, don't you?
It's not something you forget very easily."
She remembered clearly now what the Mademoiselle had shown her, that the other reef-asleep casket held someone. The person inside had been Fazil, her husband. Despite what she had been told, she had never been separated from him. The two of them had both come from Sky's Edge, the clerical era more benign than she had imagined. Yet she had still been deceived. Evidence of the Mademoiselle's handiwork was clear from the outset. Kuri's job, working as a shadow play assassin, had come about a little too easily. In hindsight, the role had served only to demonstrate her fitness for the task ahead. As for ensuring her compliance, that was simplicity itself. The mademoiselle had Fazil. If Curie refused to do what was required of her, she would never see her husband again.
"I knew you would see sense," the mademoiselle said. "What I ask of you is really not so difficult, Curie. What about the crew you found?"
"They're just traders," Manukian said soothingly. "I used to be one myself, you know. That's how I came to rescue—"
"Enough, Carlos.
Sorry." He looked back at the palanquin.
"All I'm saying is, how bad can they be?"
By accident or subconscious design, it was never entirely clear, the SISS contact craft resembled an infinity symbol, two lobe-like modules packed with life-support equipment, sensors and comms gear, spaced by a collar rimmed with thrusters and additional sensor arrays. Two people could fit into either of the lobes, and in the event of a mid-mission neural fade-out, one or both of the lobes could be ejected. Ramping up thrust, the contact craft fell towards the shroud, while the station made a retreat back beyond the safe range, towards the waiting lighthugger. Pascal's narrative showed the craft dwindling to ever smaller size, until only the livid glare of its thrust and the pulsing red and green of its running lights remained, and then grew steadily fainter, the surrounding blackness seeming to occlude it like a spreading ink. No one could be certain of what happened thereafter. In the events which followed, most of the information gleaned by Sylvestre and Lefebvre on their approach was lost, including the data transmitted back to the station and the lighthugger. Not only were the timescales uncertain, but even the precise order of events was questionable. All that was known was what Sylvestre himself remembered, and as Sylvestre, by his own admission, underwent periods of altered or diminished consciousness in the vicinity of the shroud, his memories could not be taken as the literal truth of events. What was known was this. Sylvestre and Lefebvre approached closer to the shroud than any human being had ever done, even Lescail. If what Lescail had told them was true, then their transforms were fooling the shroud's defenses, forcing it to envelop them in a pocket of flattened space-time, while the rest of the boundary seethed with vicious gravitational riptides. No one, even now, pretended to understand how this might be happening, how the shroud's buried mechanisms were able to curve space-time through such insanely sharp geometries, when a folding a billion times less severe should have required more energy than was stored in the entire rest mass of the galaxy. Nor did anyone understand how consciousness could bleed into the space-time around the shroud, so that the shroud itself could recognize the sorts of minds which were attempting to gain passage into its heart, and at the same time reshape the thoughts and memories of those same minds. Evidently there was some hidden link between thought itself and the underlying processes of space-time, the one influencing the other. Sylvestre had found references to an antiquated theory, centuries dead, which had proposed a link between the quantum processes of consciousness and the quantum gravitational mechanisms which underpinned space-time, through the unification of something called the Weil curvature tensor. But consciousness was no better understood now. The theory was as speculative as it had ever been. Perhaps, though, in the vicinity of the shroud, any faint linkage between consciousness and space-time was massively amplified. Sylvestre and Lefebvre were thinking their way through the storm, their reshaped minds calming the gravitational forces which seethed around them, only meters from the skin of their ship. They were like snake charmers, moving through a pit of cobras, their music defining a tiny region of safety. Safe, that was, until the music stopped playing, or began to grow discordant, and the snakes began to break out of their hypnotic placidity. It would never be entirely clear how close Sylvestre and Lefebvre got to the shroud before the music soured and the cobras of gravity began to stir. Sylvestre claimed that they were never within the shroud boundary itself. By his own visual evidence, more than half of the sky remained full of stars. Yet what little data was salvaged from the study ship suggested that the contact module was by then well inside the fractal foam surrounding the shroud, well within the object's own infinitely blurred boundary, well within what Lescaille had called revelation space. She knew when it began to happen. Terrified, but icily calm, she told Sylvester the news. Her shroud of transform was breaking up, her veil of alien perception beginning to thin, leaving only human thoughts. It was what they had feared all along, but prayed would not happen. Quickly they informed the study station and ran psych tests to verify what she was saying. The truth was appallingly clear. Her transform was collapsing. In a few minutes her mind would lack the shrouder component and would be unable to calm the snakes through which they walked. She was forgetting the music. Even though they had prayed this would not happen, they had taken precautions. Lefebvre retreated into the opposite half of the module and fired the separation charges, amputating her part of the ship from Sylvester's. By then her transform was almost gone. Via the audio-visual link between the two separated parts of the craft, she informed Sylvester that she could feel gravitational forces building, twisting and pulling at her body in viciously unpredictable ways. Thrusters sought to move her module away from the curdled space around the shroud, but the object was just too large, and she too small. Within minutes the stresses were tearing at the craft's thin hull, though Lefebvre remained alive, huddled fetally in the last dwindling pocket of quiet space focused on her brain. Sylvester lost contact with her just as the craft burst asunder. Her air was sucked quickly out, but the decompression did not happen quickly enough to entirely snatch away her screams. Lefebvre was dead, Sylvester knew it, but his transform was still holding the snakes at bay. Bravely, more alone than any human being in history, Sylvester continued his descent into the shroud boundary. Sometime later, Sylvester woke in the silence of his craft. Disorientated, he tried to contact the study station which was supposedly awaiting his return, but there was no answer. The study station and the light hugger were lifeless, almost destroyed. Some kind of gravitational spasm had passed him by and peeled them open, eviscerating them just as thoroughly as Lefebvre's craft had been. The crew and backup members of his team had been killed instantly, along with the Ultras. He alone had survived. But for what? To die? Only far more slowly? Sylvester steered his module back to what remained of the station and the light hugger. For a moment his thoughts were empty of the shrouders, focused only on survival. Working alone, living within the cramped confines of the pod, Sylvester spent weeks learning how to jump-start the light hugger's crippled repair systems. The shroud spasm had vaporized or shredded thousands of tons of the light hugger's mass, but it only had to carry one man home now. When the recuperative processes were in swing, he was able to sleep, finally, not daring to believe that he would actually succeed. And in those dreams, Sylvester gradually became aware of a momentous, paralyzing truth. After Karine Lefebvre was killed, and before he regained consciousness, something had happened. Something had reached into his mind and spoken to him. But the message that was imparted to him was so brutally alien that Sylvester could not begin to put it into human terms. He had stepped into revelation space.